Make our canoe. For farther north than this place, the birch does not grow. When we find good game country, we hunt.
Each made up his pack of necessary things. Ashiel brought flint and a supply of the black fire-starting fungus, but, he said, they would also carry fire with them. The morning they left, he put a hot coal from the home fire in each of three clay-lined clamshells, tied them tightly closed with strips of hide.
"We will be able to make a fire quickly," he said. "Every morning that we travel, we will do this. Each will carry a fresh fire coal. We will hunt with bow and arrows. Bring your spears. We will not use European firearms. We will be Mi'kmaq men."
Jenny, one of Noé's daughters, watched all this. One evening in the wigwam, she whispered to a friend,
"You know those white men pigs get our es, our clams?"
"I do. The big grandmother pig is the leader."
"Yes. I have a plan."
She reached behind her and took up a skin sack filled with empty clamshells. She whispered to her friend, and the other girl laughed.
"I will help you," she said.
They were up before the tide turned. From the banked night fire, Jenny and her friend took hot coals and put them in the clamshells, joined the halves together with clay so the clams seemed their usual unshucked selves. They placed the shells temptingly just above the waterline, then sprinkled a little sand over them. They waited, high up on the shore. A great sow and six lesser beasts came down to ravage the clams. The first clam was rooted up, and as it fell open, the old sow seized the hot coal. The watching girls were gratified at the terrific squealing and roaring and rolled on the sand in laughter. The old sow rushed away to the village, emitting unearthly squalls. The other hogs rooted up the rest of the burning clams, and in a short while the Acadian village trembled with porcine uproar. For the women, it was a wonderful day. The hunting journey began well. Auguste and Kuntal were excited by the new territory and the chance for a real hunt as Mi'kmaq men had made in the old days. On the third day, Auguste shot a swimming beaver, then dived into the water to retrieve it and his arrow. Before he was back on shore, another beaver came up out of the depths and Kuntar shot it. Auguste brought both to land. They ate well that night. Ashiel had picked willow and kinnikinick leaves on the way and tied the stems to his pack basket. As he walked, they cured. At night, they smoked their pipes before bed and told stories. The new territory refreshed their eyes, everything infused with the spirit of Manitou. They camped beside waters so crowded with hungry lake trout, it was the work of a few breaths to net six. They saw bears at the rotten logs, noticed the small creatures that made their livings in cavity-riddled snags, and the many owls who lived on this bounty. This was a world Wenuge never noticed, even when walking through it. After a rainy night, they woke to a spider's world of spangled webs. Heavy mist silenced footfalls and the sound of movement through brush. It was a good morning for hunting, and many more good mornings followed. Kuntal saw that Ashiel was very strong in his body and in his understanding of the unseen forces that bound all into one. Animals, spirits, people, fish, trees, ocean, winter, clouds.
"We got not much food now," said Ashiel, sharing out two small woodcock. "We hunt today. Go a little east."
They walked toward the sun all morning, and while resting at noon near a small lake, their prize came to them. Out of a tangle of small spruce, a lustrous black bear ambled onto a grassy bank. The bear was so fat, his belly trembled with each step. Ashiel shot first, Kuntal and Auguste simultaneously, then Ashiel again. The bear lay still.
"How we get him back to camp?" said Auguste. "He's too big."
"Oh, you will see. Come,"
said Achille. First we gut this bear, leave for wolves. They eviscerated the huge animal, and Achille dragged it to the edge of the bank.
Watch, I show you.
Achille took sinew cords he always carried and bound the bear's hind feet to the front feet. He jumped down off the bank, turned his back to the bear, slid his arms into the loops formed by the bound paws, leaned forward, and with a heave and lurch stood almost upright, the bear like a monstrous knapsack on his back. He alone carried it to their camp, his feet making deep impressions with every step. After he let the burden down, he made them examine his footprints.
You see how deep when a man carries a heavy burden? Sometimes that person is carrying supplies, sometimes fur packs, and sometimes a bear.
A full moon passed before they neared the end of the birch forest. Here, the hunting party stopped early one evening on the shore of a small lake. Achille looked about.
The masqui, white birch, of this forest is good, and I see trees encumbered with knots of the fire-starting tinder. We make 2 canoes with this bark, he said, even though it is not the correct moon.
Auguste, who had brought his crooked knife, would fashion the paddles. They made camp in the dying light. Auguste, who had a way with naming, called it canoe-making place. While Auguste resold his worn moccasins, Kuntaw and Achille set out for the east end of the lake in the wavering darkness of early morning, frost crackling beneath their feet. From the distance of an English mile, they could see a moose-shaped dot at the end of the lake. As they came closer, Kuntaw could see it was a young female moose in the shallows. The rising sun caught the glittering water dripping from her muzzle. They left the shore, lest she see them, and backed into the woods, circling closer, each step painfully slow and carefully placed. Long before they were near, the moose raised her head and stared in their direction. She had heard them. Kuntaw was shocked by the acuteness of hearing that let her sense their distant approach. A cloud of steam swelled into the bitter dawn with each of her exhalations, and Achille thought that these puffs were like the lives of men and animals, brief, then swallowed up in the air. Kuntaw had no room in his mind for thoughts. He was so tense his jaw ached.
Wait now, whispered Achille. Let her become sure there is no one.
After a long time, the moose splashed closer to them.
She will feed along the shore. She will come to you, signed Achille in pantomime.
Closer she came, until they could hear the tearing of the water plants. When she clambered onto solid ground again, Achille motioned, and Kuntaw raised his bow, drew back the string, and released it. The moose bled and fell.
Now you are a man, said Achille. I show you how we get this moose back to our camp.
He tied his useful sinew cords around its neck, plunged into the water, as did Kuntaw, and together they towed the cow along the shore.
Auguste said, We now may call you moose killer instead of grasshopper slayer.
They dragged the heavy animal onto the sloping shore and gutted it. Kuntaw and Auguste carried the head up to the cooking fire, and Achille followed with the heart, liver, a handful of fat, and several choice cuts.
So, said Achille, do you make up the fire now, and broil liver slices, and cook the heart slices in moose fat, and heat many small stones. I will prepare the head for baking.
They ate the liver slices half raw. While Achille split the moose skull, removed the eyes, and washed the head in the lake, Kuntaw set a flat rock in the fire. When the rock was hot, he dropped moose fat on it, then laid the slices of heart in the sizzling grease. Achille half-filled their biggest birch container with water and dropped hot rocks into it. The water boiled, and he put the moose head in. It was too large, and he had to keep turning it end on end. He kept it boiling for several hours, and while they waited, they feasted on the fine-grained heart meat. After many hours of boiling, Achille could twist the jawbone loose from the steaming head. While he pulled out the bones, Kuntal and Auguste dug a deep hole and made a strong fire in it. They continued to eat the heart slices and to throw fuel into the roasting pit while Achille gathered the herbs he needed. He scooped out half the coals, wrapped the moose head in cattail leaves, wild onions, and other flavorsome greens, put the head in the pit, raked coals on top, covered all with soil. As they finished, two Cree stepped out of the trees. They said they and their families had a fishing camp on the far side of the lake. Achille invited them all to the moosehead feast of the next morning.
"I have heard of this food," said one of the Cree, "but never enjoyed the taste." "In the morning, you will have the best food of your lives," said Achille.
The Cree came in the morning with all their bundles and dried salmon trout, for they were moving on that day to another good fishing lake. The group included two passably pretty girls and some small, noisy boys. Achille put the cooked head on a large slab of birch bark, and they all leaned forward to appreciate the enticing aroma. Kuntal and Auguste sat beside the Cree girls, eating. In the following days, as they built their canoes, they fed on moose and more moose until the Cree returned to their fishing camp.
"Moosehead Lake," said Auguste.
Achille, Kuntal, and Auguste, laden with smoked moose meat, went on, hard traveling by labyrinthine waterways interrupted by beaver dams that forced them to portage packs and canoe overland. The birch became scanty, submitting to white spruce, and finally even those trees fell away and they entered the land of little sticks, the meager black spruce and dwarf birch, and beyond them, the endless tundra. They saw a vast expanse filled with feathery puffs of Arctic cotton grass. Auguste called this "Walking in White Things" place. Here, too, was the hairy stem mastodon flower catching the low sun so that thousands of plants glowed with unearthly light. The bird millions that had passed through Mi'kma'ki earlier were in this north country, every kind of duck and goose, loons, ptarmigan, ravens, owls, and jaegers. Herds of caribou drifted across the tundra. There were broken eggshells and unripe berries without number. Sometimes they saw heavy grizzly bears in the distance. The expanse of tundra trembled in the distorting heat waves. In the distance lay great gray rocks, their surfaces brilliant with orange, black, green, and ochre lichens. On many days it was breathlessly hot, and the biting flies were a savage danger.
"Truly, father," said Kuntal, "this is the country of insatiable biting flies. No one could live here, only birds."
"We are here. We are alive," said Achille. "But did we not rub ourselves with grease and ashes, we would not last long."
The ground quivered. Dark water welled up around their feet when they stepped on land. Their canoe angled through the twisting waterways, and at every turn they saw strange new sights. At last, early frosts that turned the willow stems red warned them to turn back. So ended the summer of their great hunting journey, which would last in their memories as long as they lived, but tinctured with irremediable rage and grief. Achille carried a moose quarter for the feast that would mark their return. As they approached their home place, Achille's wigwam, they heard a terrific hubbub of tree chopping and voices calling in a fractured language. And then they walked into 200 English settlers cutting trees and building log houses where Achille's wigwam had stood. They did not speak French. 30 armed English soldiers stood ready. The remnants of Achille's wigwam smoked on the ground.
"Where is my wife? My children?"
Achille demanded, his eyes swollen with anger, and the soldiers pointed their guns at him. 6 of them rushed forward and seized the moose meat, hitting and kicking. 1 fired, and the ball gouged a furrow in the side of Achille's head above his ear. More than pain, he felt the heat of his own blood streaming down his neck. As he fell, he saw on the edge of a debris pile that once had been the furnishings of his wigwam a still shapely hand and blackened forearm. The skin burned away, exposing the heat-spasmed muscles. He knew the hand well, for he had caressed it, many times seen it preparing his food. Isabel, his wife. Everything in his memory emptied out and refilled with the smell of burned wigwam bark, scorched bearskin beds. The caressing hand metamorphosed to charred meat, the corpse-white face of a soldier and his black oily hair, the groan of a falling spruce, and English laughter. Kuntal seized his arm, pulling with reckless, frightened strength.
"Father, get up!" he screamed.
He too had recognized his mother's severed arm and hand.
"Run! They will kill us!"
Achille knew this was true, and he longed for death. But Kuntal and Auguste dragged him on, and, shot whizzing above their crouching runs, they arrived at Elfege's wigwam. And so Elfege learned the English had killed Achille's wife and his younger children, their bones incinerated in the burning wigwam. When Elfege's wife tried to treat his wound, Achille thrust her away. He preferred the wound. Kuntal wept while Achille went outside and reeled up and down, silent, but with hard, lurching footfall. Numb and disconnected, he tried to think of small things, such as weather clouds, to rid himself of what he had seen. Useless. The scene burned his mind as though he still stood before his ruined life. Everything smashed. He went back inside and sat speechless beside his brother. The day passed, and twilight softened the interior of the wigwam before Achille spoke, his voice rough in his constricted throat.
"The English have taken my wife, my children," he said. "There are hundreds of them, and armed soldiers. It is what Sosep foretold."
The brothers sat in silence. Achille shuddered, his heart and entrails knotted with pain, spoke in a trembling, unnatural voice.
"This place, Migamagi, is indeed rich and beautiful. And because of its richness, now they will take it, as Sosep told us. I hunt no more. My life here is finished. I am not. I leave this land of our mother. I will go south, do lumbering in Maine. I will despoil their land." "They will not notice. They believe despoiling is the correct way." "You are right. But I will do it anyway."
"Brother," said Elfege, "we may follow you if more English come."
"They will come."
"Father, I am going with you,"
said Kuntal passionately. And Auguste, outside the wigwam, heard this and called that he too would be with them. But several days passed, taken up with funerals, mourning, and serious talking before Achille left. A great scabby welt above his left ear, the ruined ear, which now heard nothing but a roaring sound. He said Kuntal and Auguste would stay with Elfege until he sent word for them to come. He must find a safe place first. He had to be alone to bury the memory of what had fallen on him. Elfege would help Kuntal and Auguste, but no one could help Achille. 30. Losing Ground. Achille went into the disputed border region between Maine, New Hampshire, and New Brunswick. He found Georges Frode, a middle-aged Frenchman with a great bald dome to the apex of his head, from which line of demarcation his hair flared back in thick silver waves.
"I got a woods crew 2 days south. Paid choppers good wages. I got some Indians. You all go together down to the camp. Right away."
He snorted and spat on the ground.
"Got to be fast. Everywhere there's falls, there's a sawmill nowadays. We'll cut pine all the winter.
He spat again and hitched at his drooping trousers.
I want men to work the rafts when the ice goes.
Ashiel signed up. Men were chopping pine in hundreds of places. The big softwoods fell. New seedlings burst up on cut-over ground, but now there was a break in the density of the woodland, and as new trees sprouted, the species succession shifted a little in each cut-over tract. The forest began to alter in small ways. It still lived, but it was not what it had been. Few noticed. The forest was a grand resource, and it was both the enemy and wealth. Ashiel felt it was the same with the Mi'kmaq. The white settlers used them and took them down. Four of them walked to the camp, all Mi'kmaq. There was a little snow on the ground. As they walked, the Gugugwes called and called. Rene's name for this little owl had been Shwet, and the English bent it into Sawet. The youngest of them, Perrine, was making his first attempt at a paid job. He was not more than 18 winters, thought Ashiel. Watching over him was his uncle Touche, also from Cape Breton. They reached Frode's camp boss, Alois Lagrange, in late afternoon. The man was a block of muscle, with a knife-scarred face and whiskers like pin feathers. He gave them a sour look, pointed in the direction of the camp. They found a clearing full of stumps and two rough and windowless hovels built by the loggers. One had a stick chimney in the roof and a fire pit in the single room below. Ashiel put his head inside the door, but the insufferable white man's stink made him reel.
I rather sleep with wolves than white men, said Touche.
They would build their own wigwam to keep to themselves. In the graying daylight, they quickly cut sapling poles and slabs of spruce bark, made a large but rough A-frame wigwam at some distance from the reeking hovel of the white men. They weighted the slanting sides with poles. It was shelter. In a few weeks, it would be half covered with insulating snow. When he saw the new lodging, Alois Lagrange said,
Bien, less trouble that way, keeping men separate.
He was thinking of the inevitable fights and lost days of work.
Got two other Indans, Passamaquoddy and the crew. Better they move in with you.
Lagrange said this would keep all the chickens in the same coop, so to speak. Ashiel nodded. At least the Passamaquoddy were Algonquian relatives of the Mi'kmaq. There were three groups, Maine men, French Canadas, and Indians. The Maine men, crouched around their indoor fire pit, put their various fixings in one gigantic frying pan and, cursing and blowing on their burned fingers, ate directly out of the hot utensil. The French buried a cast-iron Dutch oven filled with beans in the hot ashes of the central fire pit to cook overnight. When they had pork, they added it to the beans. These beans smelled very delicious, and when the Maine men could stand it no longer, they stole the cast-iron pot, carried it into the woods, and ate the contents. The empty Dutch oven was found a mile from the camp, near where they were cutting, and there was a tremendous fight with axe handles, rocks, knives, one man dead, and the iron pot recovered by the supperless French. Most of the Maine men left the camp the next day. When a new crew came in from Bangor, they brought a Dutch oven and a bushel of dried beans. The Indians cooked meat outdoors on the coals on the lee side of their wigwam, protected from the wind. They had no iron kettle, but the Passamaquoddy shared two good bark baskets so they could heat water for spruce tea. The Passamaquoddy had a little bag of China tea, but the Mi'kmaq preferred spruce tips and black birch bark. During the daylight hours while chopping, Ashiel kept an eye open for game, or even put down his axe for an hour or two and hunted the ridges. When at last he found a bear's den under the snow, they spent their free Sunday killing it. The frozen meat lasted a month, and the pelt went on the wigwam floor, the best place to sit. None of them had more than a few words of English, but Ashiel began to learn the tongue-twisting talk. He had several axes, including an old one that had belonged to Rene. Hard use had worn away much of the cutting-edge metal, and the thick remnant dulled quickly. He wanted an American falling axe with a heavy pole and, if he had enough money, a good goosewing hewing axe. He planned to buy these when Frode paid him for the winter's work. He thought of René and his inimitable chopping style. At this moment, in among the big pines, he missed him and wished they were cutting together again. Every chopper had his own way of doing the work, but René had been notable for quick, light strokes with his very sharp axe. He could go on chopping for hours without tiring. As a boy, Achille had found it difficult to chop in rhythm with him. As spring began its slow crawl up from the south, Georges Frode arrived on a heavily breathing horse one morning and said they had to get the logs into the river immediately. The ice was going, and with one more warm day the snowmelt freshets would pour into the heavier water. But they still had hundreds of logs to drag out of the woods.
"Forget them! Roll what we got in the water!"
The man's haste seemed desperate, and Achille remarked on it to the swamper. Léon Laflèche, one of the French choppers, said,
"Did you not know that we are in the New England colonies, and that we have cut their forbidden mast pines all the winter long?"
"Know nothing that. Thought we was in, what they call it, Brunswick."
Léon laughed.
"That is why Frode is in a hurry. The owner of this forest tract must be sending his men to seize the logs, and Frode heard of it. The owners always know where we cuttin' and let us do the work. Then they take the logs the last minute before we get them into the river."
Getting the logs in the water was the trick. The river flowed north into New Brunswick, where they would be pulled out by Georges Frode's sawmill men, and metamorphosed from the English king's mast pines into New Brunswick planks. Frode shouted and ran back and forth, urging the men to roll the logs faster. But before 30 timbers were in the drink, a gang of woodsmen and Bangor toughs, armed with axe handles and chains, burst out of the forest, and the fight was on. The militant ox teamster led Frode's troops in joyous resistance. The Maine men enjoyed fights above all else. They were grossly outnumbered, for the landowner had rounded up scores of men from the saloons with the promise of pay and an exciting fight. Those of Frode's men who could swim plunged in and made for the far shore. The logs were captured by the landowner. Frode paid no one. Most of the Mi'kmaq headed north, but Achille, who had meant to go back to Elfège and fetch Kuntaw and Auguste, could not return empty-handed. He drifted south, looking for work. 31. Follow me. Elfège, now 66 winters, was half-blind, but sat outside in fair weather. The smell of autumn, the tick of waxy leaves hitting one another on their descent to earth, let him remember the fierce colors. The leaves fell, the first winter winds swept them into hollows, rain and new snow pressed them flat. Then the woods went silent. Winters, he huddled next to the fire, buried in thoughts of colors and fog, of hunts and journeys, of the terrible day 6 years earlier when scorching tears burned his cheeks as he knelt beside Théotiste's headless corpse. Despite his 59 years, Théotiste had become a warrior. In August 1749, when Cornwallis, ignoring Mi'kmaq territorial rights, declared Halifax an English settlement, Théotiste's band attacked some English tree choppers. He escaped the avenging rangers, but fell the next week to an unknown assassin, his head a prize to a bounty hunter. Elfège was now composing his death song. Noé's daughter Phoebe, after the death of her mother, had moved in to care for him. Sometimes they guessed at what might have befallen Achille, the youngest brother, who went to Maine to chop trees years before.
"Kuntaw," said Phoebe, "Kuntaw will find him."
For Kuntaw, after much trouble with his wife Malan, left her and their boy Tawny, and went south to search.
"If he lives," said Elfège,
If he lives, many evils could befall Kuntal, as he is headstrong.
Not so headstrong as Auguste. Auguste spent much time with the English. He broke many English laws, drank whiskey, stole. He was imprisoned and beaten, but remained defiant. The English called him a bad Indian, and he took pleasure in the epithet.
One day they will kill you, warned Elfege.
No, I kill them, said Auguste.
It was true that occasionally some villager was found drowned in the lake behind the town, or washed up on the shore, the white puckered body lacerated with knife wounds. Children had wandered into the forest and never emerged, their bones found years later with great crunched holes in the skulls. No one knew how these things had happened, but Elfege had thoughts he did not wish to explore. It was amusing to Elfege that, with age, he was presumed to be a wise man, even a sagmo. Many people came to him to ask what they should do when an English housewife threw scalding water on a Mi'kmaq child begging food, or when another asked for magic help. It was a punishment to see his people half-starved, skulking around the English and asking for employment or food. There were not many Mi'kmaq people left in the world, and each of them seemed plagued by sickness, hunger, and sadness. They died easily, for they wished to die. Years went by, and Achille did not go north to his people. He kept to himself. He had the reputation of a skilled axeman. The camp toughs steered away from him. He fought with intensity and cold malice, and a man who had come up behind him in the woods and tried to club him at the base of the neck was spouting blood from the stump of his forearm. His severed hand hit the ground before he could strike. Another who crept up in the night with a firebrand to burn Achille's wigwam was himself roasted, though no one knew quite how it had happened. The man's charred body was dumped in front of the shanty. Newcomers to the logging camp were warned to stay shy of the killer Indian, the reincarnation of the bloodthirsty savages who had massacred settlers in earlier times. Kuntal heard some of these stories as he made his way from camp to camp after leaving Malan and Tani in Mi'kma'ki. He hired on as a swamper for Duquet et Fils. It was becoming difficult to find good chances of pine on fair-sized streams, so the swampers worked summers, constructing dams on the smallest rills. And the forest was dangerous. The fighting, ambushes, and skirmishes continued. Men were in a killing mood. There were more Indians in the main camps, and occasionally he heard some news of one named Sheely. He thought it might be Achille. This Sheely was a very good hunter, a good axeman. All Kuntal could find out was that Sheely was working in York State, cutting pine on the Raquet River. He made up his mind to go there in spring. It would take 2 weeks of walking, he thought. Maybe he would join Achille's crew. How surprised his father would be. Maybe they would go to Mi'kma'ki together after they drove the logs down to Montreal. He would have his wages, and they could arrange passage in a trade canoe until the river forced them to walk. The spring of 1758 came on uncommonly fast. One day the shrinking snow was frozen, and he could make good time. The next it was mush and mud. The forest gurgled and slopped. It was slow going, and when he reached the river, Frenchmen rolling logs into the black water said Sheely had gone with the first logs.
Hey, Indon, you look in Montreal, they said. Maybe Nouveau-Brunswick, maybe Terre-Neuve, maybe L'Enfer.
Suddenly, the long chase seemed foolish. He turned back and headed for Maine. There was still time to hire on a spring drive. It wasn't meant for him to find Achille. A month later, he was on the west shore of Penobscot Bay in Kattawamkeag, where crews were loading timber onto ships for export. There were several shipyards and a straggle of white man houses, one great log house, and a tiny settlement of the few surviving Penobscots. He walked along the street, fronting the bay, following five or six other lumberjacks, headed for the loggers' bar where most of the rivermen would drink, wake up the next day penniless and amnesiac. Kuntal felt very well. He was strong, his muscular body hard. He was relieved to have given up the search for Achille. Maybe someday they would find each other, but now he would enjoy being alive and vigorous. He strode along, his eyes flashing left and right as he took in the sights. After 6 months in the woods, even the poor settlement of Catawamkeag looked like a city.
"You!" called a strident voice in English. "You there! You Indian!"
He turned and looked behind him. There was a young woman on a brown horse, and she was pointing at him. He guessed correctly that she had only 18 winters, a double handful less than he.
"Come here!"
Her voice was firm. He hesitated, then shrugged and walked toward the horse. It was a valuable horse, nothing like the big scarred beasts that drew logs to the landings. He stood a few yards back from the horse and looked at the girl. She was elegant, wearing a black cloak edged in red. Something about her dark ivory face said she was part Indian.
"You like to make some money?"
she asked, moving close. She lifted her head and inhaled his odor of smoke, meat, and pine pitch. He shrugged.
"What do?"
"Split wood, of course,"
she enunciated very carefully.
"You carry an axe. Do you not know how to split firewood?"
He nodded.
"I know."
"I need you, Indian man. Follow."
Beatrix Duquet turned her horse and trotted gracefully toward the big house. He had to run to keep up with her. Watching her long, crinkled hair sway, the bright heels of her boots, he felt a wave of enchantment strike him like warm rain. So, in his 30th spring, began the strangest part of his life, as he seemed to stumble out of the knotted forest and onto a shining path. Were not René Sell's children and grandchildren as he had been, like leaves that fall on moving water, to be carried where the stream takes them? Part 4. The Severed Snake, 1756 to 1766. 32. A Funeral. On the day of old Forgeron's funeral, unusually warm for mid-November Boston, the sky was covered with mild cloud. A dozen elderly men sat in the front pews to remember the surveyor who had made them fortunes with timberland. At last, the three Duke brothers, Jan, Nicolaus, and Bernard, aided by the company bookkeeper Hank Stain, carried the clear pine casket, lacquered and rubbed to a glass-like glare, an elegant burial case for a man who had spent almost 40 years taking the measure of Pinus strobus. Jan silently willed Bernard not to stumble, not to fall. Outher, the youngest brother, should have been there, but he refused to leave the house on Penobscot Bay, refused to give up the great table, a single board from the largest pine Duquet had ever cut. This icon belonged in the company's Boston council room.
"I need it for my work,"
Outher had said with passion.
"What sort of work would that be?"
Bernard had asked of the ceiling. He thought Outher an imbecile. It was said that Indians visited him often. He could not be depended on for anything except to receive his annual stipend. Still, he should have been there. The sermon had gone on for 2 hours, but at the graveside, things began to move briskly. A rising wind wrinkled the milky sky. Nicolaus shifted from foot to foot, his boots gleaming like oiled hooves. All warmth leaked from the day as the wind hauled to the north. The brothers looked knowingly at each other. It was the Forgeron weather curse. The sudden chill urged the minister on. They lowered the coffin into the dark hole, and at last came the words, "Rest in peace." The brothers and the skeleton-thin Hank Steyn, one of the many Dutch orphan protégés who came to Duke and Sons as apprentices over the years, walked away from the graveside. In a body, the fittest mourners walked to Nikolaus Duke's house, treading in the center of the street where it was smoothest.
"Do come along, Hank," Nikolaus said to the bookkeeper, who hovered at the edge of the crowd. "Join us in farewell to the old fellow."
Nikolaus was the best diplomat among the brothers, and had learned the art of persuasion from his grandfather, Piet Ros, with whom he had made voyages to China and Japan. Now his dark hair, when not covered with a wig, was ragged gray. His face and neck had swollen with fat, though he still moved easily, unlike Jan and Bernard. Deceived by the mild forenoon, none of them was warmly dressed. They hurried on past a wooded lot, a large garden stiffened by last week's frosts, until they saw the candlelight glowing enticingly in Niklaus's front windows. Through the wavery glass they could see his wife, Mercy, Bernard's wife, Birgit, and the Panis slave girls passing to and fro with tureens and pitchers, for Bernard had brought Panis, Pawnee Indian slaves, down from Ville Marie. The door to the best parlor stood invitingly open, with Mercy welcoming them. In the center of the room, a long table covered with a fine Turkey carpet presented the collation of covered dishes, an array of silver and twist-stem glasses. Some fragrant wood burned in the fireplace. Steyn thought it might be a few pieces of sandalwood to perfume the room, a scrap of Charles Duquet's Oriental plunder. Beeswax candles in brass sconces lit the room, their trembling light reflected in a large pier-glass mirror. Hank Steyn gaped at the dozen black walnut chairs with cushions. So many, so rich.
"Please enter, dear guests. Come in," said Mercy, guiding them into the warmth.
She wore a loose gray silk sack, pleated at the shoulders over a scarlet bodice and underskirt, her wig low and neat. She often suffered from crushing headaches that sent her to a quiet room, and now she silently prayed to get through the evening without an attack. Their children, Patience, Pete, and Sedley, lived nearby, the two sons well settled into the family lumber business. Patience had married a boat builder, Jeremiah Deckbolt. Hank Steyn hung back in the entryway, staring at the luxuries and rich clothing of the guests. He felt out of place, and longed for his cold little room, but Nikolaus urged him to take a tankard of steaming cider laced with rum. Mercy led him to the cold sliced meats and Birgit's famous horseradish sauce, so stinging, she said, it would make the devil gasp.
"Hardly an inducement to try it,"
Steyn muttered to himself, and his hand veered away. He took a small marzipan cake. The fireplace crackled and spoke to itself. Yes, thought Steyn, Nikolaus Duke lived very well. And why not, with Duke and Sons swelling sails to the timber traders whose millmen converted logs into planks, barrel staves and clapboards, hogshead staves, shingles, masts, spars and bowsprits, dike timbers. All the Duke brothers lived gallant lives, except perhaps the strange one, Outher, who kept to the disappeared father's house in Penobscot Bay, and whom Steyn had never seen, and imagined as a crabbed hermit clutching a blackthorn stick. The marzipan cake surged in his gut, and he thought he might have to rush outside. Mercy glanced over the room to see if everyone had a cup of comfort, a chair, someone with whom to converse. In truth, she wished the company were different. These old men with their timber holdings. She wished very much to entertain, and be entertained by, the wealthy Boston families connected with commercial shipping, quite different from the fishing boat owners who had thought themselves the creme de la creme in her parents' day. The merchant shipping families had replaced them and built magnificent houses. She and Jan's wife Sarah gossiped enviously of their social doings. But never had any member of the Duke families been invited to their collations or soirees. Mercy told Nikolaus that she longed to give a grand party and invite these worthies, but Nikolaus said,
"My dear, you better not.
You do not wish us to be regarded as jump-ups, that most odious word. Bernard and his lanky Danish or Norwegian wife, Birgit, stood in a corner talking with Joab Hitchbone, who was even older than old Forgeron. Birgit spoke in her odd accent, smiling and nodding. What a jolt they all had felt when Bernard returned with Birgit from one of the Baltic or Scandinavian countries, precisely which one was never clear. She once told Mercy she had been born near the great Kanaan tree in Denmark. It was a shock, for Bernard had been a remarkably attractive youth with wavy hair and cobalt blue eyes. His habitual expression indicated he was about to smile, and a mole on his left cheek encouraged that impression. Cornelia, his adoptive mother, had imagined that he was the byblow of some French aristocrat and a pretty seamstress. He was still handsome, though the dark hair had disappeared, and the fine jawline had been replaced with a jowl. He limped. No one understood what had drawn him to Birgit. But their marriage, though childless, had lasted nearly 30 years. Birgit kept an orderly house and a rich table. She spent much time in the kitchen, not content to leave cookery to the slaves. Despite hoop skirts, she preferred to mix and singe and roast herself. Her flummeries were renowned. Sarah, the only daughter of the wealthy molasses and sugar importer James Pickering, had been a beauty with dark oiled hair and melting hazel eyes. She rejected hoops in favor of stiff petticoats that swelled out her skirts at the ankle, showing pink silk stockings, an unseemly mode for a woman in her 50s. Their oldest son, George Pickering Duke, had recently returned from reading law at the Inns of Court in London. For years, he had struggled against being pushed into this profession, saying he wished to go to sea, not as an officer, but as a common sailor, to visit other lands.
"George," said Jan, "it is necessary to the business to have a trained legal mind among us. You will have a good income, and in later years, you can see the world in a more comfortable manner than you would before the mast. Only ask Bernard what that life is like."
He had, in fact, talked with Uncle Bernard, who froze his bone marrow with stories of typhoons, men overboard, the paralyzing doldrums, the boredom, the eternal work, the noisome ports, the capricious cruelty of captains. George Pickering Duke was dissuaded and took his adventure in books. Bernard spoke to Joab Hitchbone, young Pete standing with them.
"Old Forgeron would have taken joy in knowing the day started with good weather."
Hitchbone sucked at his cup of syllabub.
"And how goes your pitch production? Do you still travel down to the pine woods in the Carolinas?"
Bernard made a wry face.
"Oh, no. I have ever preferred the Quebec end of the business. We still operate logging enterprises in the north. As for Carolina, young Pete here," Bernard touched his nephew's shoulder, "took on that responsibility. He works 200 black slaves, and our pitch and tar are best quality. We've done well, despite England's punitive laws."
"I return to the plantation in several days' time," said young Pete.
The older men ignored him.
"Forgeron," said old Hitchbone. "A good man, but, you know, he had some strange ideas. His outlook remained both French and English, surely an uncomfortable mixture."
Bernard's eyebrows rose.
"Perhaps you do not know that Forgeron was born in Ostend, not France. He encouraged our father to deal with the Low Countries. Father always said that Hollanders had an innate sense of landforms. That was a talent, he said, that made good timberland lookers, such as Forgeron."
But old Hitchbone went on.
"He deplored wholesale cutting, those who felled trees but took only the trunks and burned the rest. He had a frugal mind."
"Oh, he was ever a leading spirit in controversies," Bernard said. "I well remember his sentiments. He believed that men, when confronted with a vast plenitude of anything, feel an irresistible urge to take it all.
than to smash and destroy what they cannot use.
Old Hitchbone peered at him.
Ha! As we might descend on our host's table, gobble the dainties, then shiver the cups and plates on the hearth.
Few of us feel that urge, I trust, said Bernard.
I meant it as an example of Forgeron's thinking. Better you remember your Bible. And God said, replenish the earth, and subdue it, and have dominion over the fish of the sea, and every living thing that moveth, and every green tree and herb. Of course, here in New England there is such bounty of every wild resource that there is no limit to the assets, whether fish or furs or land or forests.
Bernard did not correct Hitchbone's misquotes. The old man was known for twisting scripture to suit his intent.
Then perhaps, with all this bounty, you will explain the shortage of firewood in Boston and its ever-rising price. A good thing for Duke and Sons, but driving some inhabitants away from the city.
Old Hitchbone refused to be drawn. He examined the low level of syllabub in his cup.
The Indians! That is our problem. The Indians do not use land correctly because of their raw roaming and hunting. As the Bible tells us, it is a duty to use land. And there is so much here that one can do what one wishes and then move on. You cannot make the Indians understand that the correct use is to clear, till, plant and harvest, to raise domestic stock, to mine or make timber. In a nutshell, they are uncivilized and unchristian.
Bernard dipped his head, not wishing a quarrel, but thought to himself that King Philip's war had not come about through some vague whim of the Indians. They had fought like rabid dogs to keep their lands, and they had lost. Why was hunting and plucking berries not considered as use of the land? But he kept this question to himself.
Well, sir, although Forgeron scalped Indians for the bounty, he also had Indian friends, and he once or twice remarked that the reason New France did not prosper was because of the fur trade, which pulled all the able men away from the settlements and thereby cost a great deal in enterprise and development.
There may be something in that, said old Hitchbone, but I might advance popishness being their great pitfall, and their low population, for all that they breed like mice.
Bernard ignored this and went on.
He was ever a man of contradictions. He urged Duque et Fils to keep a hand in the fur trade, which we have done in a small way. He thought that if a certain military triumph occurred, trade could revive.
They say the Ohio Valley is stuffed with beavers. If the English are successful in seizing New France, the inevitable triumph you avoid naming, that trade might become lucrative once more.
Yes, Forgeron said much on various points which did not always make him agreeable company. One felt extremely nervous near him, not only because he attracted lightning and high winds, and yet he himself did more to drive down the forest and the Indians than anyone else. And so, in him, we see the double nature of man quite revealed.
He profited in many ways, said Hitchbone,
who had himself profited in those ways.
I only saw our father angry with him one time. They were speaking of the Wentworths, and Forgeron had the temerity to tell father that he, father, could never hope to become one of the merchant aristocracy, that the Wentworths had connections with the English peerage, and knew well how to move in those exalted circles. By my God, father flew into a fury.
Hitchbone smiled, returned to the Wentworths.
I remember what your father used to say about old Wentworth. His foot shall slide in due time. Deuteronomy.
Bernard laughed.
It ain't yet slid. A wily and unscrupulous man. Forgeron amassed considerable wealth, but I was always surprised that he lived as a wild Indian on game and maize. His was a lonely life.
He lowered his voice.
I wonder who will inherit his properties.
Bernard's eyebrows rose. He ignored the question. No doubt everyone in the room was squirming with curiosity to know Forgeron's bequests, not the usual tiresome accounts of linens, laying hens, and chairs, but his timberland holdings.
Perhaps not so lonely. I have heard he had a dozen Indian consorts. May I fetch you another dollop of syllabub?
My dears, said Birgit, striding up to them, the syllabub is quite finished. Do try the maple cream cakes. Pete, dear boy, come with me instead of standing here like a fence listening to these old fogies mumble. There is a gentleman I think you would like to know.
Joab Hitchbone thought once more that she had an especially sweet and gentle voice, the voice of an innocent girl, not the tough old matron she looked. While the Indian slaves cleared the table, the women followed Mercy into the second parlor, where there were turkey-work chairs with the look of wooden animals, four or five small tables scattered among them like water holes. The women sat in front of the fire sipping China tea and laughing over rumors that the Pope worshipper Duke de Richelieu had invited dinner guests to dine in the nude.
"Aunt," said Birgit, "we have heard that after his spring success, if we may call it that, over the English at Port Mahon, his chef invented a sumptuous dressing of olive oil and egg yolk. The Duke called it mayonnaise."
They made some wordplay over the juxtaposition of nude diners and dressed viands.
"The table looked brilliantly handsome tonight, dear Mercy," said Birgit. "Oh, pshaw! Nothing compared to your exquisite collations, those blue dishes with gold rims." "You really are too kind, my dear. But, you know, four of them slid to a smash in that untoward earthquake a year past. We nearly fell out of the bed. I told Bernard that if this is one of the delights of New England, I would prefer Chimborazo. I still do not understand how, if the tremor was located at Cape Ann, as they say, it damaged so much in Boston."
Mercy sighed and said, "I expect there will be more such grief in our days as human depravity continues to irk the omnipotent." The evening wore on, Mercy several times raising her hand to her temple and sighing. At last she admitted what they all knew.
"My dear guests, what I dreaded has come to pass."
She called the slave girl to bring cold water and her headache powder.
"I must retire," she said,
and went to a back room scented with orris root and reserved for headache recovery, murmuring general farewells.
"Poor Mercy," said Sarah. "Those headaches are truly her cross. A pity after such an evening." "Yes, but a great deal of work. Mother is not really strong enough for this,"
Patience said, and waved her hand at the room and all that was in it. The guests, taking the hostess's retreat as a signal, began to leave by ones and twos. Nikolaus pressed their hands, made apologies for Mercy, and begged them to come again soon on a happier occasion. Hank Stain, the bookkeeper, bowed and grinned as he backed toward the door. Nikolaus half expected him to tug his forelock.
"Peace be with you and your syllabub," murmured Joab Hitchbone, doddering down the steps.
33. An interesting case. Then the outsiders were gone except for Jan's hollow-chested father-in-law, James Pickering, once a notorious molasses smuggler, and the judge, Louis Bluzzard. The judge's trousers were too thin and emphasized the manly bulge, the more disturbing as he was elderly.
"Judge, do show my brothers that paper," said Jan,
his long fingers tapping the side of his rum glass. Jan was the one who clinched deals with merchants and arranged contracts. He worked out complex shipping arrangements. He had the duty of smoothing the ruffled feelings of men who were aggrieved by Duke and Son's business proceedings, in part because he had the dispassionate nature of one who cares for nothing, too often mistaken for neutrality. In his private mind, he wished the axe for all royalists. The judge passed around a rather grubby newspaper, the Pennsylvania Gazette. The page showed an illustration of a snake cut into many parts, each segment with the label of one of the colonies and the motto below, "Join or Die."
"There are so many papers these days," George said, rolling his eyes.
"Ha," said Nikolaus. "That's that fellow Franklin. I knew his brother James, a family distinguished for their seditious bosoms. Ben is back here or in Connecticut now, and I can tell you that this joined colonial snake he calls for can never happen. There are too many men here who are English to the bone for all they were born here. And the tobacco colonies are markedly different from the fish and forest colonies."
For decades, Duke and Sons had managed a precarious balance between their French allegiances and the new ambitious generation of American-born men. A separation of opinions was beginning to surface. Young Pete ventured a comment. "The forest legislation the Crown has imposed on us has driven a wedge between the colonists and England, has it not?" The older men ignored his dim-witted observation. James Pickering, showing a violet silk waistcoat, spoke.
"Let me remind you, dear friends, that this city harbored two of the regicide judges a century back. There are loyalists sprinkled about, but the colonial heart desires independence and cherishes a distaste for kings and their men. It is nothing new. And is not forest legislation despised by all American businessmen?"
He turned and spat gracefully into the fire. Jan said,
"The tangled situation grows more tangled every day. Louis, tell them what you told me."
"Ah, that. I ventured to say that England's plans of attack increase the danger to your forest property in Quebec. When they take Quebec, they will take your woodlands."
The judge flicked a glance at Bernard. He considered him a little too fond of French Canada.
"Perhaps," said Bernard. "But remember that New France has a strong militia. The regional troops are excellent, and we have good aid from our Indians. Governor-General Pierre de Rigaud de Vaudreuil, I think, is intelligent and knows the country. I have heard that this Montcalm prefers to fight in European style, sieges and rigid opposing lines, Braddock's great fault. But in New France, we have developed the stealthy woodcraft style of the Indians." "That is the situation here as well," said the judge, sneering a little. "Your French half-breeds are hardly singular in their fighting abilities. But beware, there are many houses in Boston where your opinions would sound as treason."
Bernard ignored this dart.
"I have heard also that Montcalm and Vaudreuil loathe each other, and show it openly."
He sighed.
"When the French defeated and killed Braddock, I thought that would be the end of it."
The judge shook his head and gave a hard, barking laugh. He stared at Bernard.
"I think not. I thoroughly believe England will seize New France, using colonial troops however long it takes. The battle on Lake George last September shows their perseverance."
His tone was combative. Jan thought it time to raise the question. He looked at his son.
"George, after your study of the law, what is your opinion on this difficult matter? Where should Duke and Sons bestow its allegiance? France or England?"
"Would it were that simple," muttered Bernard.
"In our law readings, this particular situation never arose, but there were several of us from the colonies who discussed it privately among ourselves."
George puffed himself up a little.
"And what did you think?"
Bernard suspected that there in the heart of London, studying English law, George would have been and probably still was an advocate for eternal obeisance to England.
"We thought that in terms of law and jurisdictions, the colonies were drawing ever more distant from England. The veer became sharply evident in 1686 when the British government, concerned that we were growing too independent and too wealthy on our own abilities, sent Governor Andros to us and revoked our colonial charter."
Well, thought Bernard, so much for obeisance. Nicolaus said,
"After 2 generations of colonial self-government, this was a gross error on their part. Nor did getting rid of Andros repair the situation."
George boldly put in his oar. "And what do we have today? Englishmen in positions of power who make the decisions that affect us, who rarely know anything of the colonies, have no real experience here, nor do they wish to have. They put forth their ukases and rules based on ignorance and self-interest. What matters to them is how much they can squeeze from the colony into their personal strongboxes."
"It seems not so different in the example of France and New France," said Bernard, rather surprised at lethargic George's impassioned tone. "It may be the misfortune of all colonies.
If the rancorous discontent continues, well, I can point out a legal example that is particularly telling for Duke and Sons, as it concerned cutting the forest." George felt his importance.
"I wonder if I know your reference," said Nicolaus, squinting his eyes. "Do you mean the Dreg case of about 10 years ago?"
"No. I had in mind the Frost case, somewhat earlier than Dreg. In our private discussions, we student colonials thought it an important case. It came up only once with the faculty. A lawyer at Inns of Court saw it as evidence of the sly and impudent colonial character."
Bernard looked at young George.
"Will you relieve us of our ignorance? What was this case?"
"On the face of it, Uncle Bernard, it could have been construed as yet another example of the common tendency of Massachusetts court judgments in favor of colonial lumber millmen accused of trespassing on private land and cutting what they found there."
"Yes," said Nicolaus. "Those liberal courts were one of the attractions of the region for our father, and we have endured surveyors general of His Majesty's woods, those damnable wretches, for more than 65 years. It is right that they suffer in the courts."
He gave a small whinny.
"And how does this dispute you mention differ?"
George looked at Judge Blizzard. The judge refilled his glass of rum.
"It started, as many of our problems do, in London. Think of the massive land grants to Mason and Gorges."
He swallowed.
"To the point, in 1730 the Crown granted a 5-year mast procurement license to Ralph Gulston, a Turkey merchant, one of those swarthy fellows who trade with the Levant. The license allowed him to enter any main lands belonging to the Crown in 1691, id est, public land, and cut mast pines for the Royal Navy."
He nodded at George. George set out the case of trespass, which hinged on the date of 1691, when the land in question belonged to the Crown. After some delay, Gulston hired a colonial logger, William Layton, to cut the pines for him, and through the winter of 1733-34, Layton cut them and dragged them out. No one objected. However, in the passage of years since 1691, title to the land had passed to an American, John Frost of Berwick, Maine. The Royal Surveyor General chose to ignore Frost's title. When spring came in 1734, John Frost, waiving his legal title, sued Layton for trespass.
"I think I know how this must end," said Bernard, "but continue."
"Yes, the court, no surprise, found for Frost."
"By God, I now recall the hubbub," said Jan. "Layton stupidly paid the judgment, did he not?"
"He did," said George.
"But..."
He extended his hand as though announcing the kingpin fact on which all turned. On the other side of the ocean, when Gulston heard, he began to turn his monstrous wheels. He had the king's ear. In due time, a royal order arrived in Boston. Judge Blizzard, smiling like a wolf, took up the tale.
"It was not until June of 1738 that the hearing on the motion came before the court. Everyone was astonished when the court declared it had no authority to execute that royal order. The court's attitude was that its authority was to set out laws and hold courts for events that occurred only within the province. They claimed they had no power to enforce what they referred to as a foreign judgment.
It was the same as if they had declared an intention to disobey that royal order, do you see? It was the same as if they had said, "The king is a foreigner, and he has nothing to do with us.